Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nickturn. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle, facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit ehearnownetwork.com/David.
It's become a bit of a tradition that we launch our CSM weekends with a special guest who in some sense manifests the combo platter that we're attempting to cultivate here, which is the relationship between our creative expression, our spiritual practice and cultivation, and our livelihood. And of course, if you study deeply any spiritual tradition, at some point they tell you must return to the world and manifest in a way that is going to be productive and beneficial for you and for others. Because otherwise, you can imagine if our spiritual practice just led us to an isolated cocoon-like world of special special surroundings, it might be interesting to think, well, how are we actually fulfilling our vows? And so on the cover of my book, I actually have people coming down from the monastery. And it feels like that kind of time to me, that whoever has these wisdom traditions and these teachings is feeling an extra call to bring them into the, as sometimes we say in Tibetan tradition, into the marketplace. It doesn't mean the crass kind of business world, but the actual interaction and intersection of people and society. So our vision is pretty clear in that regard in terms of what we're trying to explore together and bring to fruition together. And in the service of that particular view, we created a platform called Dharma Moon. And this program is being sponsored by Dharma Moon in conjunction with Tibet House. And Dharma Moon is, in a sense, for me, the fruition really of my entire life. Of all the elements of life coming together in a integrated way, and trying to share that going forward. I definitely have a sense of finite time. I've told my staff and team that 5 years I'm going into the cloud, but I haven't specified which cloud. It might just be, further practice or retreat. It might be I am no longer in this particular world. But the attempt is going to be to dump, to download, to offload, in a sense, my DNA or whatever you want to call it, impressions, and pass them through really to the next generation and then one after that. So we have to see, we don't really know how long we get to live in this world. Even if you think, well, I'm young, I'm going to live forever. Time presses on us like a kind of a lever. And it becomes more obvious, I guess, if you've been a Buddhist for 50 years like I have, impermanence becomes obvious and unavoidable. But when we study Buddhism, the notion of impermanence is drilled in from the, if you're a lama, you're hearing it at the age of 5 years old. Life is short and impermanent. And so you could have a couple of different reactions to that. One is panic. One is maybe you accelerate too much. You try to get too much done. You don't really appreciate what you have. But on an ideal day, it gives us a good, healthy sense of pace, and it also helps us to release things that are obstructive to us and to others, and to cultivate goodness and compassion and wisdom. So that's the kind of arch, the arc that we're under with Dharma Moon. And I've been reaching out to like-minded people of good conscience and good heart, wherever they are, whatever stage they're at. We have a general map of sort of becoming an aspirant. You have some clarity about wanting to aspire to a particular vision for your life. And we'll talk about that tonight. And moving through to the stage of a manifester. And that's really the journey that we're articulating. So we often have special guests who, to me, represent, friends and colleagues who have explored in their own way this particular journey. So with that in mind, I'd like to introduce my dear friend, Patty Gift. And I'd like to just say a few words and then just turn the mic over to her for a minute. But I'm going to get a little verklempt, as they say. I don't know if you all know what that means. But, you know, Patty is a special friend. And she's somebody I feel like our minds are very connected. And we communicate really easily about on a different range of topics. And definitely she's been a factor. She was working at One Spirit when I started putting out my first kind of Dharma media stuff. And so she was the enabler of that. And these days, she, for quite a while, she's been working at Hay House, which is probably the premier Dharma publishing house in the world of people who are trying to put well-being and spiritual guidance out into the world. So she's the a key operative there. And so in that role, she's worked with a lot of very well-known authors, and she's edited them, and she's also coaxed them into presenting something and helped them to present something. And so she's played a very special role in terms of this community, a lot of writers that you'll be very familiar with. And additionally, Patty is a Sangha member. She's one of the Buddhist Sanghas. It's a close community. It's she studies with Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, who is a wonderful Tibetan Lama, who I knew of for years, and I recommend his books to all of our students. People read. You can tell Rinpoche that we read his books at Dharma Moon, and it's sort of top shelf, high quality teaching. And so she's been studying with him for many years at this point. So our conversation will range from talking about creativity, and then also kind of the everyday business world, her vision for her life, and how that's cooking, and also maybe just some good Dharma chat. And we'll see what happens. We'll cover the waterfront. But Patty, welcome very much. On behalf of Dharma Moon and Tibet House, welcome to you. And if you have a few opening remarks, you just can dive in.
Okay. Thank you, David. I just want to say it's so nice to be here with all of you. I scrolled through and looked at the various screens, and definitely some old faces and lots of new ones, but it just feels like a really warm community. So I'm looking forward to this evening.
So the form tonight will be that we'll talk a little bit, meditate a little bit. It's a funny thing, if you're a Buddhist, sitting still is our version of Amazing Grace. You know how Christians get together and sing Amazing Grace? We get together as Buddhists, we sit still, be quiet. That's kind of our group anthem. Is silence, stillness, and spaciousness, which is what Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche talks about, the three pills. Take the three pills: silence, stillness, and spaciousness. So maybe we could just start with a little practice together and kind of tune our minds. And I'm just going to give a little bit of instruction. Of course, there are many different ways to meditate, and they're all have their view and their efficacy. In this case, we're doing a variation of what we call mindfulness meditation. which has a center column of focusing our attention in a particular way, usually on the breath, and could be other things though. And this is technically called shamatha in the Buddhist tradition, and it means setting the mind and abiding in a particular way with one focus. And then there's also a layer of what we call vipassana, or just simply being aware of what's arising in that focused space, thoughts, sensations, feelings, and just letting them come and go, but with the notion of unbiased and unjudgmental, non-judgmental awareness. So it has those two pieces to it. If you only do shamatha meditation, you're going to kind of go into a trance-like focus, or you're just going to be spaced out. Those are the only two options there. But in this case, you can just let the technique come and go a little bit, and use it as an anchor. So when you wander, your mind wanders, you can come back to the breath as an anchor. And then as you notice, you know, mental events, emotions, just try to take the view that they're coming and going, maybe a little bit like an airport. Planes are landing, planes are taking off, but we don't have to get on every plane. You know, that's the thing. You stay at the airport, which is the observing post. So sometimes we call this cultivating the abstract watcher or witness mind, which is a much more transparent kind of mind than the one that's thoroughly engaged and kind of commenting on everything that happens, like the Muppets in the balcony, you know. Oh, she's getting in trouble now, you know. So try to just have a very light touch of mindfulness. Most people grip this too hard, you know. It's very hard to maintain awareness if you're really hyper-focused. And the idea is a light touch of focus on the breath, and then a sort of unbiased awareness of just what's coming through in your mind and experience. So the first step, of course, most of you know this already and have been to our workshops and so forth, is just taking your seat. And that everybody can just take a good seat, either sitting cross-legged on a cushion on the floor, or you can sit in a chair with your legs flat on the floor about shoulder width apart. And you can also kneel if that's more comfortable for you on a cushion. And then you can just rest your hands down, palms down on your knees, right? So you just, this is called resting the mind mudra or gesture. You see it all over the world. It's just a kind of hands resting on the knees or thighs. There should be a sense, since we're coming out of a busy, active kind of sense of stillness, settling, but not rigidity. So we say upright, but not uptight. And that's a good guide. And then maybe if you, depending on what your posture is like or your experience is like, just to lengthen your spine a little bit. So some of us are used to a little bit of this, especially these days with the computer. So just have a sense that a little angel came along and just pulled your tiny hairs up here and just went like, whoop. And that will automatically roll your shoulders back a little bit. And you can feel your back is strong and, you know, powerful, but your front is soft and open. So that's a nice dichotomy. Chin kind of parallel to the floor. And because we're doing an awareness style of practice, you can just keep your eyes open with a soft downward gaze. It's you see lots of Buddhas with this gaze. Sometimes it's called half-lidded gaze. And sometimes called seeing without looking. There's a feeling of just being aware, but not really active with the visual field. So you can drop the gaze to a point about 4 to 6 feet on the floor in front of you if you have that space. If you're sitting in a chair and you can not lean back on the chair, that's ideal so that you have your independent strength. Yeah. If you have back issues, of course, you can lean back. And at any point, if you feel uncomfortable, you can just shift your posture and take a fresh start. So we're kind of a middle way school between a very hard approach towards don't move and the kind of like very loose approach of just sit, do whatever you want. So there's a nice tautness and crispness to this posture. And then having established that, second part of the practice is to lightly place your attention on your breathing and just mix your attention and awareness with the breath. It's a very organic kind of process, and it's based on feeling the breath. So you don't have to hyper-conceptualize the breath. You are breathing, right? Everybody breathing? Let us know if you're not. Okay, and just feel that. Breath going in and out of your body. There's no need to elongate the breath or, try to create some kind of special breathing. That's a different practice. In this case, the natural breath, and just that becomes the object of your attention. And the third instruction is, you may notice either 1 second in, 10 seconds in, 5 minutes in, that you're thinking about your PhD dissertation. You're thinking about the falafel sandwich you ate for lunch today. You're thinking about your family history. You know, myriad thoughts arise and attached with all kinds of feelings. But in this case, we just gently label it thinking, just say thinking, and then bring your attention back to the breath. So you'll be coming back. The exercise is recognizing and returning, the two R's, okay? You recognize, and then you return your attention to the present. Okay, if you need to shift your posture at some point, you can. And if you get caught up, just remember the instruction to just take a light touch and come on back. So we'll just sit together, and then I'm going to talk to Patty. If you'd like to stretch, please do. So I'd like to read a short passage from the book, Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, to give us a framework, Patty, to talk about, okay? And it's chapter on joining heaven and earth. It's really the frame for the whole journey. In this book, we're exploring the process of creating a vision for our lives and making it happen. There are many ways to talk about manifesting our vision, but one classic form is the notion of joining heaven and earth. In many Asian cultures, some European cultures, and the Shambhala teachings I studied, joining heaven and earth is presented as the responsibility of leadership in particular, and of human beings in general. Heaven represents opening our minds, expanding our horizons, and envisioning possibilities. Earth represents being practical, grounded, and mastering all the tiny details of life. When heaven and earth are joined or synchronized, we can experience harmony and prosperity. If we look through the lens of heaven and earth, we can often see when and how our grand schemes go off the trail and into the weeds. Sometimes we have big visions, big plans, and all our moves are lined up and ready to go. Then suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, we don't have the right circumstances, the right help, the right resources, the right amount of money, the right weather, the pandemic, you name it. Our heaven, our vision was so clear and so good and so right, but we've literally and figuratively run aground. We've crashed into earth, and suddenly our lofty dream turns into a challenging one, maybe even a nightmare. In these cases, we may temporarily connect with the heaven principle, but we lose our connection with the earth. However, sometimes we're so efficient, so capable, so much in control of the details of our life, but something is missing. The whole enterprise starts to feel hollow and meaningless. In this case, we don't seem to have a clear vision. There's no big picture. We're simply operating to get our ever-growing to-do list accomplished. But what's it all for? What's the meaning? In this case, we've conquered earth but lost heaven. When I teach Buddhism in Japan these days, I often stay in a hotel that on a clear day has a view of Mount Fuji. Even though the mountain is more than 50 miles away with its snow-capped peak, it seems to penetrate and sometimes even dominate the surrounding and intense imagery of a wildly urbanized Tokyo. I like to see Mount Fuji because it reminds me of the vast and unobstructed sense of heaven, of the open and clear quality of the Buddhist teachings, and the reset button we can always push to allow ourselves a more spacious and open state of mind. It's helpful to periodically connect with the heaven principle, however we can access it. Dear Patty, what is your heaven?
Well, the thing that came, top of mind when you were reading that was the way that my teacher, Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, talks about spaciousness and how we can connect with it. And it's by gazing at the sky. And so whenever I want to have some experience of or a taste of heaven, all I need to do is look at the sky.
So Tenzin Wangyal, does he present that sky gazing as sort of a heaven principle? Is that word ever used?
You know, he doesn't actually talk about it as a heaven principle. I suppose that's just a connection that I've made, mm-hmm. that when I'm feeling too tight in myself, you know, kind of like too turned in on myself, too lacking in connection to vision or something greater, that is a way that I can reconnect.
And can you tell us a little about sky gazing as a practice? It's a very famous Tibetan practice.
Yes, although I can only tell you this much about it, and I would say I don't do it in any sort of formal sense when I'm doing this, but I especially think living in, or maybe I'll come at this from a different space if that's okay, David, that one of the things that Tenzin Wangyal talks about a lot is using different elements, connecting with different elements in nature as a way of finding something that we may need at any given moment. And And, you know, especially as someone who lives in New York City, which I'm guessing a lot of you probably do, sometimes it can seem like nature is a bit of a challenge to find. But the sky is usually something that we can see in the city, especially on a clear day when, it's brilliantly blue. And so I would call my sky gazing practice an informal sky gazing practice. I mean, that's something Rinpoche talks a lot about too, the difference between formal and informal practice. So really it just consists of, as I was saying before, if I find that I'm like really constricted, that doing even a few minutes of staring at the sky can be incredibly opening.
You know, Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about mixing mind with space, that you have a sense of your mind mixing. And he emphasized going with the out-breath and dissolving out into space. It's interesting because it's really quite an advanced meditation technique that he taught as for the beginners. He never really taught, actually, Shamatha Vipassana. He was teaching, he was calling it that, but it really had the a flavor of Mahamudra meditation in it, which is just, he would say, out-breath and just dissolve. And gap. And then the in-breath happening by itself, and then out-breath and dissolve and gap, which is very much part of that mixing the mind with space. So by visually connecting to that field, do you feel that your mind expands in some way?
100%.
Just by using the sight.
Yeah. And I use it. It's been so beneficial in my work because, at any given moment in the middle of a work day, you get an email, you've just had a meeting with someone, and you get kind of tweaked. And when I'm feeling that, and then I need to go on to the next thing, but I don't want to carry that that me into we're about to be photo. I knew this would happen. This is my cat Chai. He's very lovely, but we're gonna send him on his way. But if I don't want to carry that me into the next situation, that this doing that like little bit of informal sky gazing is a way to let go of it.
Yeah, wonderful. There's a great video, which I will, Michael, if you remind us to share with the weekend participants of the sky gazing practice. They show a series of some of the greatest lamas of the 20th century doing that practice. You just you can sort of see the flavor of it. It's very expansive and very open. And of course, the trick is to not space out. Right, because that's something we talk about a lot with beginning meditators. If you're relating to that space element, which is a pacifying element and a very soothing and expansive element, but you can get attached to that feeling of that, and then next thing you know, it's 4 hours later, and somebody's tapping you on the head, and your building's on fire, and you are sitting there. Yeah. So, how do you differentiate between mixing the mind with space and spacing out? What's the difference?
Wow, great question. Well, I guess I would say how I experience it is when I'm experiencing more or feeling more spacious, I'm more grounded in my body. Yes. Sort of more, I feel more, my whole being is more integrated. Yes. And when I'm spaced out, I am not in my, I'm as far from my body as it's possible to be.
Yeah. Great. So there's actually body sensations are alive during that?
Very much so. Yeah.
And, body is a sort of interesting domain. And in the heaven and earth paradigm, heaven is mind and earth is body. So at an individual level, we talk about joining heaven and earth. It's synchronizing mind and body at a personal level. So you have body practices that you do with Tenzin Wangyal. Aren't there practices that involve physical exercises and so forth?
Yeah, the ones that, yes, there are. The ones that are taught most frequently, it's a series of five practices that's called Salung. And they're all seated movements where you're synchronizing a movement and breath. Yeah. And it's to move the energy in the body. And I don't do those so much for my daily practice, but I do use them from time to time. And I find those really beneficial too.
Powerful too, right?
Very powerful.
Yeah. And tell us how long have you been practicing with Tenzin Wangyo Rinpoche? How did that come about?
Ah, that came about because of you, Moji. So for any of those, or for those of you that may have known Noji for a little while, you've probably experienced this extraordinary ability he has to kind of lead you somewhere that you didn't realize you wanted and needed to go. And when he was talking about when we first met earlier and describing how we were working on these creative projects, so he would come to my office every week or two, and we'd have, you know, long, juicy creative discussions. And then he'd suddenly change the subject and he'd say, so let's talk about your spiritual life. You know, like, what are you up to these days? What are you studying? And he'd ask really insightful questions. And then he'd always close with a zinger, which is, and how's that working for you?
I did.
You did. You did. You would always hit me with, and how's that working for you? And it was so helpful, because at a certain point I realized it wasn't actually working for me. Because, you know, up until having those conversations with you, I had sort of been, I guess you would call, kind of a spiritual grazer. You know, I'd sampled lots of different things, and I'd spent some time doing serious study in one or two areas, but I kind of hadn't found my place. And then David started, you know, very skillfully introducing different Buddhist books, and, you know, would tell me to check out certain teachers when they came to town. And finally, at one point, I realized, oh, I would really like to find a root teacher. And so I went to David and said, okay, you got me to this point. Who do you think my teacher should be? And without hesitation, you said, Tenzin Wangyo Rinpoche. You should check him out. And I think something like 3 or 4 weeks later, he was teaching at the Open Center. And went to that workshop. He walked in the room, and I sort of knew when he walked in the room that, oh, this is the person. And that was 16 years ago, 17 years ago, I guess.
No.
So I know, time flies.
Oh. Well, and we should say, and especially since we have special guests here tonight, that part of the logic of it, not that it was logical in like Spock, but there was a certain thread of logic to
totally.
It, was
yeah.
that you clearly, at least from my perspective, expressed an interest in the Buddhist view, and you had that kind of curiosity about that, but you also had studied the shamanic tradition with our friend Alberto Yoldo, who's here tonight, and he was your shamanic teacher. And so I thought, well, Tenzin Wangyo brings those two threads together. That's true. Tenzin Wangyo is from the Bunpo tradition of Tibet. He's also a Buddhist Lama, but he's, you know, the Bunpos have more of the kind of direct link to the shaman tradition of Tibet, the pre-Buddhist, shamanic tradition. So I just thought, well, you're a hybrid plant. You're a yellow tomato. You should go where the yellow tomatoes grow, you know? And wow, 16 years ago, Patty, that's stunning. So you've been studying with him for 16 years.
Yeah.
Whoa. And how's that working out for you?
I think pretty well. I think really well, actually.
Yeah. He is still around. Is he teaching online? How do we access him if we want to?
Yes, he is. he's not teaching online right this moment, but he'll be back, I think, in about a month, because he's been on a sabbatical. And he was meant to be doing this entire pandemic year as a sabbatical, but he was starting just as the pandemic hit. Yeah. And he realized that his students needed him. And so he has been coming out of retreat, teaching online for a while, and then going back into retreat.
And is Hay House publishing his books now? Did you cross over that line where you became his publisher as well as his student?
Yes, we've published 3 books together in the last, I think, 6 years or so.
What are the titles?
Well, the most recent, actually 4 books. The most recent is Spontaneous Creativity. So interested people.
Get him on the podcast.
Oh, you definitely should.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also Awakening the Sacred Body, which is based on the Salung practice, and then Awakening the Luminous Mind, which is all about vision as mind, and the True Source of Healing, which is that elemental practice or practices that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah. So you have brought those into the world. You've midwived his teaching. You've done that for so many people, Patty. So I think it's, you know, when things happen, there are who the mother is usually pretty obvious, but who the midwife is not always on the front page and kind of highlighted. So you've been a midwife, if I could just borrow that concept, for so many powerful communications from people who've been really training and practicing and want to communicate with the world. And you enable that. You help pull them out into that. And for example, there's second example, as long as Alberto and Marcella are here together, that you have a book coming out from Marcella, who I think a lot of our community knows because she's been coming to the Tuesday night class. So what's that book about?
It's very much Marcella's story, which is quite dramatic and beautiful. And it's also about, as a medicine woman, walking the healing path and a kind of reclamation of the divine feminine.
Oh. So
lots of juicy, juicy things going on there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it. I'm about to... Is it published yet, or are we still in?
No, it's pre-pub June, Marcella. I think that's right.
What a gift that you're both mentioning my book, Awakening Your Inner Shaman. I just realized that we have 2 words in common with your book, David: awakening, and then mine is a woman's journey of self-discovery through the medicine wheel. So here, the wheel, you also have the wheel in your first book. So very vicious coincidence. And this is coming out in May, but you can pre-order in Amazon.
Okay. We're gonna put out a little plug for it. But I have a copy of it that you sent. It's okay just to send that out to our mailing list, right? The book as it is that okay?
No. It's your private copy, David.
Okay. You know, it's such an interesting time we live in. I heard a talk, Patty, at South by Southwest on intellectual property, that it's over, basically. Intellectual property has another 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, and then after that, it's going to be impossible to track it. So make the money, Marcella, while you can make it, okay?
Yes, and I must say, I must honor my midwife, Patty Giff.
Much,
Patty. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could share a little bit of what it was like to work with her. Would you feel like doing that?
Well, a true gift, because in the beginning, my book was only my story many years ago. And like Patty said, a very dramatic story. And it really... there was a point in which I outgrew my story. I just want to burn my story and bury it. And like, who wants to read my story anyways? It made me so bored. But then I was able to bring the teachings of the shamanic teachings, like what got me out of that drama. And I have been teaching shamanism for so many years now. And so I could now weave in other people's stories, my students' stories and other people, and make it very rich and speak about a mythology and a cosmology that is from the Andes, but it's not so separated from the cosmology of the Himalayas. I mean, spirituality is really one. So it's very rich in that way. And what was so beautiful about working with Patty is that she saw my book many years ago, and she kind of like believed that there was a book to be born. Because I had the opposite experience. I showed my book to another publisher about 7 years ago, and she was very much a feminist, and she said, "Who wants to read a book of a victim, disempowered woman, whatever, that then falls in love with her guru and so forth?" And she just said, your book is crap, you know.
Oh.
So anyways, that was the best thing she could have sent to me, because my warrioress came alive from that criticism. And I said, no, my book, there's something here. So I showed it to Patty, and Patty believed in me. Yeah. And then we really outgrew the book to what it is today, like a teaching that so many people can relate to. So it's not just about me, but so many people can relate to. And Patty was just really gracious all along. And she had such a, her compassionate, kind heart really show. That's how she gave me feedback again and again on how we can make it something very valuable for so many people, something universal. So a true midwife. Yes. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And Patty, have you published Alberto's books, any of his books, or he has a big time publisher somewhere?
Yeah, I've published just a few.
Ah, you have? all of them?
Not quite all of them, but
wow.
He and I first met when I was working at one of those big time publishers, which was even before you and I met.
Right, I know.
And so we did a book together. I guess it was probably 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, which was the first book that we published together, and that was through Random House. And then we actually ended up at Hay House independently of each other.
Yeah.
But reconnected there. And
wow.
Now done lots more together. So.
You know, they say it's a small world until it's your turn to either paint it or clean it. But you have a profound connection with. Now, this is a very CSM kind of story, because not only are you friends, you're very good and dear friends, you're working together, and you're also bringing out a kind of spiritual, tradition that they both represent. So that puts you, you're in an interesting position. It reminds me a little bit of our friend Stefan Rechtschaffen, who I said is the lemonade, has the lemonade stand in the middle of the New Age, festival. And everybody sort of passes through there. He's the reason a lot of us know each other too. But you're sneakier than he is. You're just finding these lights, and you're putting a spotlight on them, and you're helping them to manifest their vision. So I'm going to ask you a tough question, Patty. Is that okay?
We'll see.
Okay. Well, you don't have to. And we're very sweet at Dharma Moon. Nobody has to answer anything they don't want to. They don't have to. We're not into that hard thing. Let's say you were going to write a book. What would that be?
Actually, people ask this a lot. And over the years, many, many, many people have said, when are you going to write a book? Also, I've been to any number of soothsayers, whether it's a palm reader or a tarot card reader or psychic, goes along with the job. And they all say, someday you're going to write a book. Oh. I have never had that aspiration. I genuinely enjoy working on other people's material. It just doesn't, you know, my left to my own devices, me and a blank page.
Yeah, not happening.
Not. I don't find that as interesting.
Yeah. Well, I can connect with that because it's sort of like being a producer. You know, I produce a lot of other people's music, like Krishna Das and a lot of other people. And, you know, it's interesting when they bring their, you know, array, their thing, and then you are the person who's helping to prune it and frame it. I get what that feels like. That's a great thing. But I have a title for your book. Do you know what it could be?
It's probably some sort of play on gift. But
we haven't even got to that yet. It's called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Book.
Oh my God.
making a book. Yeah. What do you think? And it would be as told to Nuji.
Oh, that could be fun. Yeah. But if with my publisher's hat on, I would probably say to me, too close to somebody else's book title, so not good for like the Amazon search.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so you raised an issue that is notable. I have hung out with you with more seers, psychics, intuitives. You are just loaded for bear with people who have that those kind of gifts, and it's almost like. Knowing a gypsy and everybody in their family plays a musical instrument. You know, everybody you know has some kind of intuitive gift. So why do you think they're all saying that you're going to write a book then?
Oh my God. I honestly never thought about it.
They're supposed to know, right?
Well, they're not 100% right.
Well, let's pivot on that. Do you think, what do you think about the future? Do you think you can know the future?
No.
So what are all those people doing?
This does feel like a tough question.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt your livelihood either, but...
that's exactly where my mind right. was. No, do I think you can tell the future? Not in a black and white sense, mm-hmm. No, but I do think, I mean, I've seen this with you, Nuji. I mean, you said like you and I have a particular kind of connection. And when we're out in the world together, whether it's something specific to me or other people in our orbit, like you tune into, I guess we could say like the field. Something, and you will come out with, you know, like you'll know something. We're at a restaurant and we're being served by someone, and you'll know something about that person's life that you've just pulled out of thin air, seemingly. So I think whatever you're tapping into, these people have the ability to tap into that same field. And they're getting information that can apply in the future, but I don't see them as telling the future in that black and white sense of, you know, like unequivocally, this thing is going to happen.
Yeah. So, you know, some people would say, and it'd be great to get Alberto and Marcella in this conversation at some point too.
Totally.
That it's like a quantum field. And that our notion of past, present, and future is kind of a linear superimposition upon the quantum experience. And so you can, you know, they do say, as you know, you did a book with His Holiness Karmapa, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the future is now.
Look at, well, kaboom, look at that. there it is. So the future is now. Holy mackerel.
That was actually the first book that I bought at Hay House.
What? That you brought into Hay
House? Yeah.
And what was the point of that? What was he saying? What does that mean?
he was saying that the future is, you know, it's that thing of, I never get this thing right, but this saying right, but, you know, the idea of the only time we have is this moment, you know, it's, mm-hmm. you can't have the past and you can't be in the past really, and you can't be in the future. So all you've got is now.
Oh, I see. So it's emphasizing just get with the now.
Yeah.
Boy, now is so popular in the spiritual world, isn't it?
Yeah. Be here now.
Well, the power of now. Now this, now that, you know. So, you know, I don't know if you've ever talked to Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche about the fourth moment. Have you ever talked about the fourth moment?
No.
Why don't you ask him? Tell him David Nickern said, what about the fourth moment, Rinpoche?
Okay.
But in a nutshell, there's past, present, and the future, and the fourth moment.
Are you going to tell us more than that, or are you going to leave it?
No. Even now, you cannot hold now. It's never now. It's like, whoop, there it went. You know. So the fourth moment is that sense of, you know, they say the Karmapas, you probably have heard this, but they're knower of the three times. Have you ever heard that expression? Oh, omniscient Karmapa, knower of the three times, which is referring to past, present, and future. They know, Buddha is supposed to know reality completely with beyond the temporal display. So they can, in a way, have a very accurate sense of future and particularly your past. God, they can really see that, where you came from. But without the Buddha's omniscient eye, you know, with that complete development, the rest of us are guessing as far as I can tell. You know?
I know, I certainly am.
So. Yeah, and so am I. And I'm a playful person, so I don't mind taking a guess, and I don't even remember what I said sometimes, you know? So if it's helpful to somebody, that's the mark. I think playing with those kind of energies is neither here nor there, but, you know, it should be in service of the person's journey, right? You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, very much so.
Some people trip around on that kind of stuff, right?
Totally.
Yeah. So you're fantastic. Let's just call it like it is. You're an amazing person, Patty.
You're gonna make me blush, Noji.
Yeah. You know, and you've really, so, you know, I wonder if you could write the book that's similar. Was it Uspensky, Meetings with Remarkable Men? Who wrote that book? I think it was one of Gurdjieff's students. Does anybody know?
I know the book, but I can't think of the author.
It might be interesting for you to consider writing about all the unusually gifted people that you've worked with and a fisheye lens into that world, you know? You have had, you know, we don't always see our unique perspective, but looking at somebody else's life, you can see you've had an unusual, succession of high-level teachers that you've had, you know. Did you do any work with the Dalai Lama?
Not personally, but through a Hay House connection, I was, I think this is probably 10 years ago or more now, but I was able to go to India to see him and be in a very small group with him there. And the most incredible thing that happened at that, I think it was like a 3-day session, was one morning I was sitting in the front row, and he wasn't sitting on a high throne. He was sitting on a kind of like a chair level throne, and we were all seated on the floor. And so I was maybe 2 feet away from him and just totally enwrapped. And at one point he asked me a question, and I was so startled that my mind went absolutely blank. I don't even remember what I said, but he just, you know, with that amazing gaze of his, just looked at me and said, I think if you meditate more, you will be happier.
Whoa.
Yeah. It was.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
He out of the blue just said that to you?
Yeah.
He never says stuff like that to people. I don't think that's a common thing, because he could say it to everybody, right?
Yeah.
He could just go walking down the line, the reception line, saying, I think if you meditate more, you'll be happier. I think if you meditate more, you'll be happier. So that was a specific blast.
Yeah, it totally was. And it wasn't, you know, at that point, I'd already been studying with Rinpoche for a number of years. I'd seen other lamas, but it hadn't really landed. You know, I hadn't really, I just hadn't connected, I guess, with the practice in a very deep way up until that point. And when I got back from that trip, it was like, okay, you know, I guess I had to go however many thousands of miles away and hear it from a lama of that level to like really get the message.
Yeah. And did that actually instigate a deeper engagement with practice for you?
It did. And I was super fortunate because it coincided with Tenzin Rinpoche's, with his creation of a secular meditation program, which is called the Three Doors. And it's a 2.5 year meditation program that really, I mean, I have told all my friends, like, it remade me from the inside out. You know, it was like my life pre Three Doors. And then by the time I graduated, it was like going from black and white to Technicolor. Because it just, you know, my experience of everything was so changed from doing that. So, yeah.
Wow. Astonishing that there are so many stories about some of these great lamas that are, when you think about it, you think, well, of course, what did he say to you? But the impact that it had, the transmission aspect of it, and the fact that it kind of just merged with your live stream in that kind of way, that's real cities, that's real powers there, and very ordinary at the same time. So, and you have a picture of you and the Dalai Lama together, right? Don't you? I think I've seen that.
Yeah, that was from that journey. And yeah, and it was interesting because up until that point, I'd you know, for whatever reason, I think many people feel that way. I'd always felt very connected to him, even though that is not the tradition in which I
sure.
you know, study and that I inhabit most of the time. But I just feel such a strong and warm and so much respect.
And do you have a picture of yourself with Karmapa?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think that we were photographed together.
It's okay. We'll Photoshop it. We can do
okay.
it.
Okay. All right. Awesome.
And do you have a picture of you and Alberto?
Many, thankfully. Okay. And some from many, many, many years ago. It was funny. When was it, Alberto? Like last year or the year before that, you sent me a photo and asked me, is this you? it was, I think, probably from the late 90s. And we were on a glacier in Peru, because I used to travel to Peru with him every year, which was so, I mean, that was such an amazing, amazing time in my life and an amazing experience with him and, you know, really solidified our friendship in a very, very, very deep way.
Well, so Patty, here's the book. Are you ready?
Yeah.
It's a series of pictures of you with these great teachers. And the title is "Who Are These Guys with Patty?"
but there are many great ladies or women, I should say.
Okay, too. Who tell us about it?
Well, Louise Hay.
Ah, how could she's got her name over the title? Hay House.
Hay House, yes.
Could you share a little about Louise Hay, who's kind of your mentor in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll start with the story of how I ended up at Hay House, which is, I mean, even I who believe, and when David and I were doing kind of the pre-check, I said something about, you know, I'm not really this kind of person, but I'm going to use the phrase, the universe is telling me something. And he said, Patty, you are that person. You do say these things. It's interesting because I had this thought when you were reading from the book about when someone comes crashing down to earth, And I had, this was probably 13 years ago, a little bit more than that. I had taken a job that I thought was my dream job. And I was at this company for about a year and a half, and I realized it was actually my nightmare. And I thought, I'm going to stick this out because maybe it'll become my dream job. And then I got to the point where I could do everything that was being asked of me, and I was even more unhappy. And I had a friend visiting from Colorado, actually someone, oh my God, Midgey, you show up in this story too. It was someone that David had connected me to, who was Kelly Notaris, who also worked in publishing. Kelly and I did not know each other, but she assisted a workshop David offered. And David said, I think you and Patty need to meet. There's something in there for the two of you. I helped her get a job at a publisher outside of New York because she wanted to leave New York. Then she came back to New York. We're having lunch. I'm telling her I'm not happy. And she says, so where do you think you want to go? Because, you know, you've worked all these other places. And I said, well, I'm really interested in Hay House, but I don't want to move to California. And a week later, I got a phone call from a friend saying, I just met with the head of Hay House and they want to open an office in New York. And they asked me who they should hire. And I said, you, are you interested? Yeah. And that was kind of this time of year. And then I talked to the CEO and he said, great, I want to hire you. There's just one caveat. You have to meet with Louise. And, you know, if she gives you the thumbs up, then we're good to go. And so she came to New York and we met for lunch and we sat next to each other and held hands and told each other stories. And I was telling her about, talking to her about the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa. And she, even though that wasn't her, you know, bag, so to speak, she was so respectful. And we just hit it off. And so I got the job.
Wow.